Let's Talk Development, Season 2, Episode 3.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Ejaz Nabi at CDPR, which is the Consortium for Development Policy Research. And I'm delighted to be hosting today Dr. Sadiq Ahmed. He's from Bangladesh. He knows the economy of Bangladesh extremely well. He also knows Pakistan very well. He was country director for Pakistan at the World Bank and resident in Islamabad for 5 years. He then returned to Washington to become director for economic policy in the South Asia region. So he covered not just Pakistan and Bangladesh, but India, Nepal, Sri Lanka also. So he, Bhutan, Maldives. So he has an extensive knowledge of the region. He's visiting Lahore and Islamabad and Pakistan after many years. But because he knows both Bangladesh and Pakistan quite well, it'll be great to hear from him what he has observed so far on his visit and whether this shows the differences in growth outcomes, living standards outcomes that a lot of people are talking about these days. So first, we will ask Dr. Sadiq Ahmed for his broader impressions, and then we will talk more specifically about some economic determinants of these broad trends. So, Dr. Sadiq, very welcome. It's wonderful to host you in Lahore. You are still very active as the brain behind setting up the Policy Research Institute in Bangladesh, and you are very actively engaged with the government of Bangladesh. So, given all of that experience and your current engagements, it'll be wonderful to hear from you first your early impressions on what you notice.
Assalamu alaikum, and thank you, Ejaz, for inviting me to come to Pakistan after 12 years now. So it is a wonderful opportunity to catch up, not just on the country, but very good friends. And we have very fond memories and very, very good friends. It was good to renew. Basically, you know, I always thought Pakistan had great, I would say, potential. Relative to that, the potential, I think there's still a way to go. But overall, even this visit to Lahore, which was one of my favorite cities because I spent quite a bit of time visiting it, I saw quite a bit of prosperity. Now, of course, I have not gone to the rural side, so I really do not know what is going on there. Urban areas, it gave me a sense of, you know, it's a booming city, a lot of traffic, a lot of construction work, a lot of reconstruction work. Even at the airport, I saw the amount of the passenger traffic and all that. So my sense is, you know, although when you look at numbers and all that, you get an impression that there are lots of concerns. Of course, there are concerns. But on average, I would think that there is quite a bit of good things going on. There's quite a bit of prosperity. It may not be shared prosperity because I think the rural economy, I have not seen exact picture. So it would be superficial for me to say that this, but in general, it's not a country or an economy in dire straits or in depression. So I think overall, very positive.
Well, that's good to hear. But I'm sure once we start digging a little deeper, we will see what the risks are and
absolutely
what some of the difficulties are.
Absolutely.
But Sadiq, having heard from you your the impressions of your visit on this occasion, let's go to Bangladesh and tell us a little bit about how the Bangladesh success, which is clearly it is a success, it has overtaken Pakistan in many, many indicators of well-being. On several indicators of well-being, it is also doing better than India. We know that in 71, 72, Bangladesh had to start from virtually ground zero.
Right.
So tell us, highlight to us the big turning points.
No, Bangladesh is an inspiring story, I would say, for the developing world, for the reason that, you know, if you remember the famous phrase that Kissinger is alleged to have said, that basket case, and the reason was because it was, the poverty level was very, very high. In 72, over 80% of the people were considered as poor. Income levels were very, very low. Human development indicators were very low. And so there was a lot of concern, and there was no known resource base. No, natural resources was almost unknown. And there's a lot of climate change-induced problems of flooding and cyclones, etc. So there was a concern that whether this, you know, new country can survive on its own without huge amount of foreign aid and all that. So that downside was always there. But I think what Bangladesh has done is it has surprised, I would say, even in the development profession and everybody, to show that development is very much possible. It's not so much where you start from, it's so much what you do. And I think even without the resource base in the sense of natural resources, Bangladesh relied on things that they have. And one of the best things that they had is human resources. And they made very good of use it. So I think that was one thing. Bangladesh also had one very advantageous situation in terms of location, because it is located around the sea. So it has a port openness. And, you know, that those two advantages, to my mind, overwhelmingly offset the disadvantages. And of course, it required very good thinking and policy making.
Right.
Surely there were issues about political stability and all that. And as you know, the first few years, first, I would say 10, 15 years, there was some, turmoil. There was also a famine in 1975. But it rose from all those concerns, and it gathered together a strategy, I would say a development strategy, which did not change, even if with the change in government. I think that is one a remarkable aspect, which basically, I would say, came to recognizing that the source of growth would be the private sector. And based on its best asset, which is human development and human resources. So how do one convert this asset that you have into a real productive asset? That was the challenge. And I think Bangladesh showed that if you are able to use even your limited resources to basically invest in human capital, invest in the women's empowerment, those are the two striking aspects of development as I see it and compare it with other countries, and then combine it with incentives for private sector and provide the resources coming from within the economy. Initially, there was a huge dose of foreign aid, but very quickly, the substitution happened. I would say by 1990, the savings, domestic savings rate and the domestic investment rates more or less offset the foreign grants and other assistance that they got. And that, to me, was also possible because of human development, because as you know, the Bangladesh's total fertility rate came down very, very rapidly. It also paid a lot of attention to agriculture. I mean, people forget that food sector, because, you know, basically what it did was it made sure, learning from the famine of 1975, that food self-sufficiency was essentially critical factor.
Yes.
And it also kept the wages low, because if your food is affordable and they manage their macroeconomy in a way, the inflation rate kept low. So a combination of low inflation, high national savings, high investments, and then private sector-led development and human development. I think that's a very good combination for development.
Right. Absolutely. Now, we can take this one step further in terms of reducing the number of key variables that Bangladesh seems to have focused on to make the transformation.
Right.
I would say there were three key variables, three key factors. One is, as you said, human development. The second, I'd say, is agricultural productivity, which you have mentioned. The third, I would say, is a niche of industrialization in the area of ready-made garments, because that put Bangladesh on the global scene.
Right.
In a way that the first two elements would not have done. So you needed some activity, economic activity, that would put you on the global scene, and that was ready-made garments. Now, my question is, and we've discussed this at the recent LUMS conference also, when we compared India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh in development experience. In Pakistan, we keep talking about the need for political stability to make the transformation. And people associate political stability with long majority-dominated democratic framework of governance. Now, we see in India, the transformations happened at a time when the government was not a strong government. These are weak coalition governments, but they pushed through reform. In Bangladesh, we saw a lot of political uncertainty.
Right.
But till this recent tenure of the current Prime Minister, Hasina Wajid. But earlier years, there was considerable uncertainty and instability. And despite that, Bangladesh didn't lose sight of these three key ingredients: human development, agricultural productivity, and ready-made garments. So tell us a little bit about what it took to keep that focus.
On the ready-made garment, I think that's a very important point, because the ready-made garments is also an embodiment of use of the assets, human development, because it's a very labor intensive. Initially, they started with very low levels of technology. And when they first started, they started with a lot of human capital, particularly women's employment.
Yeah.
And they were doing pretty, well, I would say, basic type of ready-made garments exports. Now, Bangladesh does not grow cotton, as you know. So it has to import most of its raw materials. You know, it imports the yarn, then it makes it. It also imports the thread, then it makes the yarn and all that. So despite all of that, this is a hugely import-intensive industry also. So what Bangladesh did was, it first of all, it used the labor force effectively. They were low cost. They gave them the basic training. They also imported the technology from partnership with Daewoo with in
Korea.
In Korea, and they learned the techniques from them, and then adapted to the local situation, and then gave some special benefits to the ready-made garments industry, which is called the bonded warehouse system. Basically, what they did was they simulated a duty-free import regime for them, because the import cost, otherwise the high import cost, even devaluation or other things could have created a lot of headache. But the beauty of the RMG sector was that they would also combine this with what they call back-to-back facility, meaning that you can import and then pay for the import through your exports. So the exchange rate effect was completely gone.
Yeah.
You can, because you're a net exporter, so you're benefiting. You can't pay on the cost side.
And this our complex duty drawback system
is gone.
Is
it totally irrelevant? And they, of course, also gave a lot of other. But the bonded warehouse system was a kind of a feature, which is not available to other exporters, unfortunately. Yeah. But it offset the adverse effects of a protective trade regime, and therefore that industry took off. And once they took off, they allowed a lot of investment and the domestic sector, and so there was a lot of competition. And then what I'm particularly surprised, I wouldn't have expected it, the amount of response that came from the private sector in terms of market understanding, and quickly they penetrated the major markets. European Union, of course, they benefited from the least developed country status and got the duty-free status. United States does not provide any duty-free status, so pay about 15-16% duty, but still they're competitive. That tells me the garment sector would be competitive even with 15-16% duty.
The best large stores in the United States sell.
They sell. I think they I would, and that's where I give credit to the entrepreneurs.
Yes.
And what the political system did was, it did not matter who came in power, which regime was in there. As far as my understanding goes, none of the regimes created any headache for the ready-made garments industry. In fact, for any industry for that part. As I said, the development strategy started in real earnest, I would say it started in the 80s, but 1990s were the starting point. You can say it was also a democratic transition from the earlier periods. But basically, the continuity in policy has stayed, irrespective of who came to power. Private sector dependence, support for the private sector, support for ready-made garments, and then the support for human capital, support for women's empowerment, partnership with the NGOs. But that's a very important yes. feature, because that meant that you have a low-cost delivery. Bangladesh is a resource constraint. Even with the high savings rate, its tax resources are very limited. So the government's ability to spend on health education is limited. But whatever they did, whatever they spent, they made sure that they spent on the right things. And by drawing a partnership with the NGOs, they made the delivery system much more effective. Less, I would say, leakages and all that stuff. So as a result, the outcomes are very good compared to, say, even India, which spent a lot more money on human development, and Pakistan, which spent similar amount of money. So delivery system is as good or as important as the... And so that, I think, continuity of policies, irrespective of political regime, the focus on food, focus on agriculture, focus on ready-made garments, Pakistani, I think, has paid off. Plus, I would say the role of remittances.
Yes.
Because I think, every government has basically supported the out migration. I mean, through training, through information, through making, banking services available.
Travel facilitation. Yeah.
And making it easy. And I think now there's a lot more activism also. The foreign ministry gets involved in avoiding any kind of harassment of workers and all that on a national level, which I think is very helpful. So I think they got these policies all right. Remittance policy, the RMG policy, agriculture policy, and human development policy. These have been, and then of course the microcredit. I think the microcredit is, I would give a lot of emphasis on that, because what the microcredit did was the gender empowerment that happened through microcredit is amazing. Because the Grameen Bank, which came with this idea that women have to be the source of the credit, that revolutionized the thinking process in the rural economy, empowered the women, and therefore gave them the asset with which they became an earning member. So they cannot, they cannot have any dominance in that sense. So I think those policies have worked very well, and I would give credit to all governments for promoting this strategy, without regards to their political differences or political, affiliations and all that stuff.
So, thanks. This is a very good and comprehensive overview of the factors that help explain Bangladesh's success. There is an argument that beginning at ground zero has, of course, disadvantages, but it also has the advantage that there are no deep stakeholders who have an vested interest in continuing with an entrenched system of rent seeking. Whereas now let's shift the focus a little bit to Pakistan, because it was ground zero, and because the NGO movement reflected the patriotic energy that people were willing to bring to the country to help deliver services, but also broader governance. So those were some of the key elements. And there was no entrenched political interest that ruling parties were defending. So in that sense, they had to rely on whatever the dynamic forces were that would change Bangladesh. So they were not beholden to those special interests. Mm-hmm. Let's move a little bit to Pakistan in the light of this story of Bangladesh. In Pakistan, of course, we have very deep entrenched interests in the status quo. People have made a lot of money in the status quo. We have had our share of political uncertainty, but we also have one very stabilizing factor, which is, you know, the armed forces, which are which are a disciplined, well organized unit, has a tremendous tremendous presence, but then also has a large expenditure associated with that. Very early on, I wrote a piece comparing Bangladesh and Pakistan, and really what was freeing up Bangladesh to pursue its human development, or at least to launch the journey of human development, was the fact that it didn't have such heavy, inflexible, rigid expenditures, such as large interest payments in the case of Pakistan, and the defense expenditure. To what extent do you agree that these are very important features that distinguish?
Absolutely. Before I come to the fiscal aspects of your question, and also the human development aspect, I think one major difference between Bangladesh and Pakistan has been on the macroeconomic management. When Pakistan was growing very rapidly in the 70s, 70-90 period, the 6% growth rate, it did not do so on the basis of its own savings and investment rate. It relied very heavily on external. I think that, to me, was a major setback. That put Pakistan in a bit of a, difficult ground.
Dependency
and sustainability.
Yes.
I think most important thing is sustainability. And then combine this with the very, inability to mobilize tax revenues and all that stuff. And then the defense spending, which has to be high for the reasons you mentioned. So that left very little for, first of all, they are dependent on the foreign countries first. And that's political, as you all know, how much money comes in and that. So I think that all of these things unraveled in Pakistan at around the same time. And in some sense, I would put it this way. If I look at Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, my sense is Pakistan is probably the richest country in the region. I look at the agriculture. I look at the natural resources. Amazing. Pakistan grows almost everything.
Richer in terms of resources.
Resources.
Yes.
Richer in terms of resources. And of course, it has the human capital. Potential human capital is there. It's not converted.
Yes.
It is there. And what Pakistan needs to do is to basically invest in human capital. But that's number one priority. If you ask me today, gender empowerment has to be done. I think these are the two things which sets Pakistan a bit, backwards in terms of the more in the other direction of development. But it has an excellent, I would say, labor force, because I've seen some of the work that Pakistan artisans can do, the furniture industry, the garment industry, the home textile industry, outstanding kind of. So it is not lack of, I would say, human capital in the sense that capacity or potential. Opportunity, training will open up the gates. And export orientation. Right. I mean, that's another thing I will put. Pakistan has to be a bit more focused on exports. It has to, if it controls its population, for example, population growth, it reduces total fertility and all that. Demographic dividends it can utilize by raising, it has to raise savings rate. You can't really grow an economy to 5-6% with the 13-14% savings investment rate. That is not possible even with the most efficient use of capital. I think there, look at Bangladesh, look at India, as two examples in South Asia, there are other examples. 30% in the, they're approaching 30% range in savings and investment.
Yes.
Now, maybe you don't need 30%. Maybe you can do better productivity. But 25% plus savings and investment rate, I would say, is needed for Pakistan for at least another 10, 15, 20 years in order to invest in the human capital and in the productive sectors of the economy.
Right. So, Sadiq, let me, in the last few minutes that we have, let me turn to South Asia as a region,
right,
and what our respective roles are, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India roles are in that region. Before the separation of Bangladesh, Pakistan Institute of Development Economics was a world-class think tank.
Absolutely.
And the leading players in that think tanks were Bangladeshi economists. At that time, East Pakistan economists, but subsequently Bangladeshi economists. So there was a lot of exchange of knowledge from one wing of the country to the other wing of the country. I really think that there's a lot of learning that can be done from each other, Bangladesh-India-Pakistan. There's a lot of learning that can be done and how to manage the transition from being low middle-income countries to middle-income and then higher middle-income countries as well. Because, you know, we are almost 2 billion people, more than 2 billion people. That's a lot of people and hardworking people. Bangladesh gets about 25 billion or so in remittances. Pakistan gets 30 billion remittances. India gets about the same amount in remittances, which means that our workers go all over the world and they are productive workers. That's how they're able to send back remittances. So what I'm saying is that I always think that there's a very bright future for the region as a whole.
Right.
I would like to hear your views on that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think if you look at the strengths are tremendous. And this question of low productivity is a function of the environment in which you are functioning. But the same people, some of the best doctors in USA are Pakistani doctors. Some of the best, you know, scientists are Indian or Bangladeshi or Pakistani. So I think they get a different environment. You get a... So there is inherently, there's nothing, no problem. You have to get the opportunities. You have to get the facilities. And you have to get the environment. You have to create the incentives for that. And I think that way, that whatever population size, I think it's, India is 1.4 or...
1.3.
1.3. Pakistan is 2.
2.4.
So, and Bangladesh...
No, not 2. 240.
Yeah.
0.24.
0.24. Bangladesh is 0.2. So, basically 1.
Almost 2 billion.
Yeah. Now that population, of course, has to be converted. Not everybody has to be converted into productive assets. And that can be done. And that's why I said investment in education. Yes, there are also problems of governance and institutions that we keep on talking about it. But there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that potentially this is not an Africa syndrome.
Yes.
We have tons of, I would say, workable institutions where private sector can grow despite whatever government in-house fighting.
The banking systems.
Banking system is working. Telecoms is working. ICT is working. Private sector is working. Private education has come up in some
ways. Transportation.
Transportation. So I think the governments, government can really inspire and not be a barrier to this. And that's why they say unshackling. There's a book written by one of my friends, Ajay Chibar, on India, Unshackling India. What he's talking about is saying deregulate.
Yeah.
Deregulate, reduce the government's interventions in the economy, all kinds of interventions, not just the productive interventions. You know, the SOE sizes are very small, state-owned enterprise. Bangladesh is very small.
Yeah.
But we are talking about cost of doing business, you know, bureaucracy, you know, innovation. And then, you know, do away with the barriers.
Yeah.
Why is South Asia so closed to each other?
Yeah.
It's open to the rest of the world, close to each other.
Yeah.
The visa system, the, you know, it is mind-boggling. I mean, you can have political differences, you know, China and USA and Russia, but they're not stopping the flow of people. And so I think to me, the learning is there. Trading will be a huge way of improving. So learning, trading, some of the best education institutions are in India and in Pakistan. Some are in Bangladesh also. There can be a lot of... So I think opening up the South Asia region is very important. More regional cooperation on issues of water, for example, on environment, on climate change, will be very, very proactive, very helpful. Lowering the transport cost barrier, moving people and moving goods and services will be very helpful. They will only accelerate the possibility of South Asia going up.
Absolutely. And so bottom line, invest in human development.
Yes.
Raise agricultural productivity.
Absolutely.
So there's plenty to eat for everybody. Become export-oriented. and to facilitate that, open up barriers.
Remove all barriers.
Remove barriers within the country, but across the region. So there's a lot of learning from each other.
Right.
So that all of us can grow and prosper.
Absolutely right.
For which you agree that there is enormous potential.
Oh, you're absolutely right. One other point I'll make here, in closing, which is also the government, the countries rich, governments are poor. They don't know enough taxes.
Yes.
And as a result, they cannot really take care of the poor.
Yes.
And that social protection spending, healthcare spending, there should be universal healthcare.
Yes.
Universal education, at least up to grade 12. The social protection programs must be working. I think that's the only way you can lift.
And you need enough revenues to be
enough able to revenue. I would say 5 to 6% of GDP, at least on social protection for each country.
Yes. And that social protection includes basic health and early years of education.
Early years of education.
Thank you very much, Sadiq. This has been a very interesting, productive.
That's fascinating. Thank you for inviting me. I really thought it was a very, very productive visit. I really enjoyed
Thank
it
you.
A lot.
Thank you
so
very
far.
Much. Thank you.